America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us.
And greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Chris Slattery was going to be with us at this particular moment in time. We were going to talk about these kind of anti-abortion clinics that are popping up around the country. It is in the news, but given what happened with Scooter Libby yesterday and a few other things, we've rescheduled Chris to next week. So we appreciate Chris's willingness to be with us and look forward to talking with him next week. And Larissa Alexandrova will be with us in the second hour of our program with a breaking news story you're not going to want to miss. Welcome to the program. Our telephone number, 866-303-2270. If you want to drop into our live chat room, you can do so by going over to TomHartman.com and the blog over at AirAmericaRadio.com. And I guess that's all the underbrush out of the way. Now.
Enemy lines.
Yes. What is going on here? The real story behind the story. First of all, yesterday I am looking at a screenshot from Fox News, and there's Brit Hume, and it says breaking news. This is, you know, the slogan there below breaking news. Scooter Libby found not guilty of lying to FBI investigators. That was Fox's lead story. That Scooter Libby was found not guilty of one of five counts. Yeah, but that's, I kid you not. Scooter Libby found not guilty of lying to FBI investigators. That's what it said on the screen as they talked about the Scooter Libby story. But there's a deeper story here. And Chuck Hagel, by the way, Esquire magazine, new issue of Esquire magazine. The president says, this is quoting Chuck Hagel, former voting machine company president, but also current Republican senator from Nebraska, and increasingly out of step with the president, and therefore, in my opinion, candidate for president. He says, the president says, I don't care. He's not accountable anymore. Hagel says, measuring his words by the syllable and his syllables almost by the letter. He's not accountable anymore, which isn't totally true. You can impeach him. And before this is over, you might see calls for his impeachment. I don't know. It depends on how this goes. End of quote from Esquire magazine, an interview with Chuck Hagel. And this is where I want to get to the issue. Dave Lindorf did a great piece on this that you can find over at commondreams.org today. It is the top story up there. And it really gets to the core issue of this thing. If you open the Wall Street Journal today, as I did this morning, and you look at the very last page of the first section, the last inside spread of the first section, you see the editorial page on the left, the official editorials, the op-ed page on the right, the, you know, guest editorials, as it were, and the official editorial in the upper left-hand corner and the op-ed editorial up in the upper right-hand corner, both calling for presidential pardons of Scooter Libby. Now, keep in mind that, you know, the Wall Street Journal's editorial page is essentially the core basis, the starting point, very often. I would say, I don't know if 9 times out of 10, but very often, very frequently, is the starting point for the right-wing talking points for certainly all of conservative talk radio and much of the rest of conservative media. This is what we're going to be hearing over and over and over again. This is what's going to be pounded on today by conservative talk radio. And it's already made its way into the mainstream media in a Washington Post editorial today that is reciting, quoting, or repeating rather, right-wing talking points that are just plain old, simply flat-out false. And I want to get to that in just a minute. But first, it's really important that we step back and say, what's the story behind the story here? What's the issue behind the issue? Is, you know, in the case of Bill Clinton being impeached, for example, the story behind the story. The story was he lied to a grand jury. The story behind it is he was lying to the grand jury about having sex with Monica Lewinsky. The story behind that, I suppose, if you want to take it to the biggest picture, is, you know, the guy wasn't faithful to his wife. Now, is that you know, an issue that, you know, should provoke a constitutional crisis? Is that something that we should be all terribly, terribly worried about? Lying to a grand jury is a serious thing, but, you know, okay, so here now we have Scooter Libby. He's been convicted of lying to a grand jury. Same thing. And obstruction of justice. Perjury. He's been convicted of a series of things. As Joe Wilson said last night on Keith Olbermann's program, Countdown, Countdown with Keith Olbermann, well, here his comment, just pretty straightforward.
I take no satisfaction in this. I think that the idea of a senior White House official being convicted of obstruction of justice and perjury is something that ought to sadden everybody who believes in public service.
Yeah, and you know, well said, Mr. Wilson, Ambassador Wilson. But there's even a story behind that story, and that's, many people think that this is the story of the outing of Valerie Plame. But there's a story behind that story that we're missing and that I think that we should really be focused on. And none of the mainstream media is talking about this. None of the official corporate media of America is talking about this. And that is, why did Joe Wilson feel the need to write that editorial in the New York Times, or was it the Washington Post? I believe it was the New York Times. That provoked Dick Cheney to write on, in his own hand, on the margin of the editorial, basically marching orders to Scooter that caused Karl Rove to leak to Matt Cooper and Scooter to leak to I believe it was Judith and others, the identity of Valerie Plame. And where did that all originate? And this brings us back to the famous 13 words in the presidential speech. And this is, frankly, where we should all be looking. Just like Watergate was not a, you know, it wasn't just a burglary, and it wasn't just about spying on the Democrats. It was about specific intelligence and information that Richard Nixon was looking for. This is about those 13 words. And if you go back to this, this goes back, this originates in 2001. A few months after George Bush has been elected to office, but before 9/11, there is a pair of burglaries in Rome in the embassy of the country of Niger. One at the embassy and one at the home of the ambassador from Niger. And the only things stolen were official stationery and official stamps, the stamps that you use to make a document look like it's a real, legitimate official government document. There was a person arrested and prosecuted for this. It was a cleaning lady. And as during the trial, it came out that she was also a former member of the Italian intelligence service. So you have to ask yourself, you know, why is, now this is, keep in mind, before 9/11. Now go forward, as Dave Lindorf points out in his piece at LibbyGate, let's get to the real story over in commondreams.org. Now go forward to the month after 9/11. This is about 2-3 weeks after 9/11. Silvio Berlusconi, remember our Berlusconi alerts? Oh, Solomino! We were doing them all the time. Silvio Berlusconi, the guy who bought radio stations and TV stations and newspapers until he controlled about 90% of all the media in Italy and then ran for prime minister. And, gee, what a surprise, he won. He comes over and meets, along with his ministers of defense and intelligence, with George Bush in the White House. And there, according to the reports, he gives to Bush some documents that were forged on the letterhead of the country of Niger with the stamps that had been stolen in these burglaries that looked to be receipts for uranium ore bought by Saddam Hussein. Now, first of all, why Saddam Hussein would want a receipt for something that he's not supposed to be doing doesn't make any sense at all. You know, hey, I'd like 400 tons of yellow dust. Don't tell anybody, but I do want a receipt. Huh? But anyhow, Berlusconi gives these to Bush. Bush turns them over to the CIA. This is according to Richard Clark and Paul O'Neill. National Security Council to Counterterrorism had Richard Clark, former Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill, cabinet member. Bush is pushing for Iran, for a war with Iran and Iraq. Actually, Iraq, almost as soon as he finished reading My Pet Goat, as Dave Lindorf says. Bush turns these things over to the CIA. The CIA says, these things are nonsense. This is nonsense. They throw them away. They set them aside. Okay, so this is October of 2001. Now we jump forward another 3 months, and there's a meeting in Rome. And at this meeting in Rome, something very strange happened with these documents. I'll share that with you right after this break. And this is where we get to what I consider to be an impeachable offense. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Welcome back to the radio, home of democracy. Air America Radio, the Tom Hartman Program, 21 minutes past the hour. Okay, let's just recap real quickly. In the spring of 2001, before 9/11, after Bush becomes president, there's a break-in at the home of the ambassador to Niger and at the embassy of Niger in Rome. The only thing stolen is official letterhead for Niger, for the country, and stamps, seals necessary to make a document look official. A few weeks after 9/11, Silvio Berlusconi, the prime minister of Rome, and a multi-billionaire because of his media connections, he started out as basically a small-time crook and businessman and built this huge media empire, controlled virtually 90% of the media, particularly the electronic media in Italy, comes over and meets with Bush and hands over these phony documents. Bush hands them over to the CIA that say that Saddam Hussein was getting yellow cake from Niger. Berlusconi trying to do a favor for his friend George. George hands them over to the CIA, says, hey, can we use these things? The CIA says, hey, wait a minute. These documents reference people who aren't even alive. I mean, there were such badly done forgeries, the CIA immediately spotted them. And so they deep six them. So now we fast forward about a month later, December of 2001. That was October. Now, 2 months later, December of 2001, there's a meeting in Rome. The Defense Department Undersecretary for Policy, Doug Feith, is there. Michael Ledeen is there. Actually, I'm sorry. Doug Feith is not there. Michael Ledeen, who works with him, is there. Larry Franklin, a top Defense Intelligence Agency Middle East analyst, who later pleaded guilty to passing classified information to two employees of the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, is there. Ahmed Chalabi, convicted bank swindler and the guy that we're paying $300,000 a year to give us information about Iraq, is there. Harold Rode, of the Defense Department Office of Special Plans, is there. And the Italian Defense Department and SISMI, the Italian Intelligence Agency. And at this meeting, according to La Repubblica, which is sort of the opposition newspaper in Italy, and again, I refer you to Dave Lindor's story today in The Common Dreams, Libbygate. Let's get to the real story. According to La Repubblica, it was at this meeting, Dave writes, at that meeting that a plan was hatched to resurrect the forged Niger documents. But the CIA has already said these things are phony. So the Bush administration knows that they can't take credit for them themselves. So what do? They're going to try and recycle them through British intelligence. And this is why in the Bush's State of the Union address, he says the British government has learned that Saddam Hussein recently sought significant quantities of uranium from Africa. Now, he knew when he said that the document he was talking about was the one that Berlusconi had given him, that he had handed off to the CIA. The CIA had said, this is phony. He knew it. Here is a clear lie in the State of the Union to the American people to justify a war. That lie that Bush told us, and the plot that was hatched behind that lie by guys like Michael Ledeen, Ahmed Chalabi, and Harold Rode, and the guys from the CISMI, from the Italian Intelligence Agency. That is what was used to sell us this war. That is what was used, knowing that it was false, to sell us this war. And that is what caused Joe Wilson to write his op-ed in the New York Times saying, sorry, guys, I went to Niger. There was no sale of uranium to Saddam Hussein. Which is then what led Dick Cheney to say, how dare this guy talk the truth about this carefully constructed lie that we put together along with the intelligence agency from Italy, and that we've stovepiped up through the Office of Special Plans, our little mini intelligence agency inside the Department of Defense, inside Don Rumsfeld's office. How dare these guys, how dare Joe Wilson tell the truth about this? We can't have that. Take this guy down. And if you can't find something to hit him with, hit his wife. Because we are, after all, dealing with a group that has been taking their cues for a long, long time from Godfather 1 and 2, apparently. And as Dave Lindorf points out, none of the corporate media in the United States have really pursued this story. What was the story behind the story? I mean, this was a black operation, and the target of it was you and me. And if that's the case, and all the evidence seems to point that that is the case, then, as Dave Lindorf says in Common Dreams today, this is high treason. It's not just Libby, he says, who should go to jail for this crime. It's the president and vice president. This is a high crime and misdemeanor. This certainly rises to the level of impeachability. George W. Bush lying to the American people. And that's why, in my opinion, Bush has probably already called Libby, who, by the way, was Mark Rich's lawyer and negotiated Mark Rich's pardon, but with Bill Clinton. I mean, Libby is no stranger to pardons. I'll bet you Bush has already called Libby saying, keep your mouth shut, I'll bail you out. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
And welcome back. It's the pill that will help you escape the matrix. Tom Hartman with you on Air America Radio, 34 minutes past the hour. The point, two really important points to make here, and then we'll pick up some of your phone calls. Number one, this is not about political revenge. That's how it's being spun in the media, and that's what they want you to think. They want you to think that this is about Bush and Cheney and Scooter Libby and Richard Armitage and Karl Rove being small-time, you know, politicos trying to get political revenge. This is not about political revenge. They weren't trying to take down Joe Wilson and discredit Joe Wilson because they wanted revenge. They were trying to do it because they were trying to stop a story. A story that leads right to George Bush's door. A story that could lead to the impeachment of the President of the United States. The story that Silvio Berlusconi had his intelligence service break into the Niger embassy and the residence of the Nigerian ambassador, is not Nigerian, the ambassador of the country of Niger, and steal letterhead and stamps and fabricate these documents about phony yellow cake uranium, and that Bush then found out that these things were phony. He knew that they were phony. The CIA said they were phony. If Berlusconi didn't tell him, I'm guessing Berlusconi gave him to him and said, oh, look what we have. Wink, wink, nod, nod. But we know that Berlusconi came for that meeting. And this was before 9/11. See, which all goes back to the idea that Richard Clark and others were saying that, and John Snow, for example, the Treasury Secretary, that Bush, before 9/11, As soon as he came, as soon as he was appointed to presidency of the United States by the Supreme Court, by the men on the Supreme Court who were appointed by his father, and the guy that his father was running, Mr. Reagan, as soon as these guys appointed him president, his number one job was to attack Iraq. And so Berlusconi comes over and says, I'll help you out. Here's a phony document that you can use to show this to the American people. And they'll go, oh, my God, Saddam Hussein is trying to build a nuclear bomb. We've got to take him out. It's phony. So they decided to recycle it. They go back. There's a meeting in Rome now after 9/11. Hey, it's after 9/11. We can use this now. Let's recycle it through the British intelligence. And a year later, Bush has got it in his State of the Union address. That's the story they were trying to stop. They were trying to stop any investigation of it, and there has been no serious investigation of this beyond these facts that are simply laid out. I mean, they're out there, but nobody has put the two to two together. And so I'd say, you know, we're on the air live in New York City. If there's anybody from the New York Times, the New York Post, the New York Daily News, any of the major newspapers in New York, hey, pick this up and run with it. We're on the air live in Los Angeles. If there's anybody with the L.A. Times, Seattle, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. We're in Washington, D.C. Hey, where's the Washington Post on this? I mean, this is a big deal. So, number one, it wasn't about political revenge. It was about trying to cover up a crime committed in the White House that is impeachable. And number two, consider, Mark Rich was probably the most controversial pardon that Bill Clinton made. It was probably the toughest one for him to make. He had to be sold that pardon. Remember Mark Rich, the wealthy financier whose wife had given a lot of money, $300,000, as I recall, to the Democratic Party or Democratic causes? He took the most flack for that. And who was Mark Rich's attorney? Who was the guy who set up that pardon? Scooter Libby, when he was a high-priced Washington lawyer during the during the Clinton administration. So here's a guy who is very familiar with the pardon process. He has set up presidential pardons. And he started out his defense. His defense lawyer started out by saying, we are going to prove to you that Scooter Libby was just a toady. He's a low man on the totem pole. He was just doing what his bosses, Karl Rove and Vice President Cheney, told him to do. And you shouldn't hold him accountable. You should be holding them accountable. Essentially, that was how the defense was laid out in the beginning. Everybody was talking about how they were going to draw, you know, Cheney was going to come to the stand, and is this going to be a constitutional crisis and all this. And all of a sudden, in midstream, Scooter Libby's defense strategy changes. Bang! Just like that. Stops dead in midstream and changes to his defense lawyer going before the jury and crying and say, please give me back Scooter. In other words, there was no defense. Now, why would he do that? My personal opinion is that the only reason he would do that is if he got a call, probably a personal call, from George Bush saying, it's 684 days, 11 hours, 17 minutes, 18 seconds until I leave office. One day before that happens, I will pardon you. If you can just drag this thing out for 684 days, and don't worry, Mary Matlin is out there. She's already raised $3 million for you for the Legal Defense Fund. And, of course, you're a multimillionaire to begin with. You're fairly well off. So, you know, and we'll make sure after we're out of office that you're taken care of. Just hang on. Because they don't want this story to go any farther. They don't want it to get back to the phony documents that Berlusconi gave to Bush. They don't want it to get back to Bush after he was told by Condi Rice, after he was told by the CIA that it was a lie, putting this in the State of the Union address. They don't want to get back to that. This is about a cover-up of an impeachable offense in the White House. This is not about political payback. This is not about trying to punish Joe Wilson because he was a truth teller. It's about trying to stop the story. 1-866-303-2270, our phone number. Linda in the Bronx. Hey, Linda, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's on your mind today?
Okay, I told your colleague that I wanted to talk to you about Alberto Gonzalez, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Please allow me to do this, but to be responsive to what you've just been discussing, I'd like to say this. I understand, in fact, I actually went to Andrew Sullivan's website last evening. I read where he said pretty much Congress or to get Dick Cheney, issue him a subpoena if he refuses to appear before a congressional committee looking into this, then he ought to be brought on impeachment charges. So
I agree.
The point is, in terms of everything that you've laid out, and sure that there are more dots to connect, and you do it brilliantly, but clearly it has been placed on a silver platter by Fitzgerald and that wonderful jury, wonderful in the sense that they were diligent in their deliberations. They put on the platter for Congress, Congress, here you are, let's go. All right?
Right. And now it's up to the Democrats. And let me say, Linda, that it's not just up to the Democrats. It's up to you and me, because Congress very rarely acts unless they get a lot of pressure from their constituents or from lobbyists. And they're not going to get any pressure from lobbyists on this, so it needs to be us. We need to be calling 866-220-0044, toll-free number for the Capitol building, and asking to talk to our members of the House and Senate and saying, we want investigated the Niger documents that Joe Wilson was talking about that led to this whole thing. We want that investigation of what's going on, what went on in the White House that was used to justify this war. We want to know how we got into this war, and we want to know if it's an impeachable crime.
Well, you know, absolutely, Tom. And hello?
Yeah, I'm still here. You're still here.
Absolutely. And I will tell you that that's excellent advice for all of us. I have written to Congress. I've written to my senators, Schumer and Clinton. I've written to my congressman, Ms. Elliot Engel, on a number of matters, so I'm not...
But don't just write to them. Call them.
I will do that, too. That's easier.
Because that actually has more impact. Letters, if you send letters to Washington, D.C., sometimes it takes them 6 weeks to get
them
because of the security.
That's true, too. I will do both.
And so call.
With regard to Alberto Gonzalez, Tom, you know, I'm old enough that I was attending medical school in Washington, D.C., during Watergate. From actually where I lived, I could look down 16th Street and look at the White House.
So you remember the Sunday night massacre?
I remember so vividly as if it were yesterday. Let me say this about Alberto Gonzalez. In the wake of these firings of U.S. attorneys for no reason other than the fact that they were doing their jobs properly, I will tell you, to me, Mr. Gonzalez he makes John Mitchell look like an amateur.
Yeah,
and in terms
agree.
Of what Congress needs to do, Congress needs to, you know what, I guess really my question to you is, Tom, and to the listeners, can not Alberto Gonzalez be impeached?
Yes, he can.
That's my question.
Any federal official can be impeached.
And I think what we need to be getting at. So I'll call Congress, and I will talk to Mr. Engel. I will leave messages for Schumer and Clinton regarding all of this, including Alberto Gonzalez. He's the worst.
Good on you, Linda. Good on you, Linda. Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. Jason in Grand Rapids. We have just a minute before we have to take a break. Jason, what's up?
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Just real quick. First of all, this is very clear. It's very plain. Everything is laid out. And if the Democrats don't do anything, with this is clearly impeachment. This is all illegal. So the only thing they have to do is gather up the will to act.
And that will, I guarantee you, is not going to come from inside them. Politicians. Animals and we have to be the herd, right? We have to be the parade. If they hear from enough of us, they will do something about it. And the same I'd say with the corporate media also. I would not hesitate to contact my local newspaper and say, why aren't you covering this story? You know, there was a story behind the story. It was all about the documents on Niger. Yeah.
Right.
So, okay. Good point.
Okay.
Well made. Jason,
thank you very much.
Good to hear from you. I mean, this is the bottom line here, and we're going to take a break in just a second, then we'll get back to your phone calls. But this is the bottom line. This isn't about trying to trash Joe Wilson with Valerie Plame. It isn't about political revenge. It's about trying to stop a story in its tracks, a story that could lead to the impeachment of Bush. Not even Cheney, Bush. Because it was Berlusconi and Bush who were meeting when the documents first came into the possession of the White House before 9/11. When they were planning the invasion of Iraq. 45 minutes past the hour.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
And welcome back to your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Now you get it. Why, when you open the Wall Street Journal on the editorial page, the two lead editorials, the lead guest editorial and the lead official editorial, are both calling for the pardon of Libby. Why, an hour and a half after the verdict came down, William F. Buckley's National Review is calling for the pardon of Libby. Why, every conservative talk show host in America today is going to be calling for the pardon of Libby. Why, the Washington Post ran an editorial this morning, tragically, falsely repeating inaccurate, to be charitable, statements that have been made by right-wing spinners that would suggest that this wasn't that big a deal. They all want Libby pardoned. They all want Libby shut up, because if he talks, then he might start talking about why they went after Joe Wilson. And the reason why they went after Joe Wilson was because Bush knew that those 13 words in the State of the Union address were a lie. He knew that document was a lie. He knew he was selling the war to us as a lie, and that the selling of the war had begun back in the summer of 2001, before 9/11. And that's when Berlusconi first came over to the United States and met with Bush and handed off those documents. And that's what they're trying to deep six, because they know it will be the end of this presidency. This is our Watergate moment. The burglary has happened. The burglars have been exposed. Now the question is the burglar, right? In this case, it's all they've got is Libby. Is he going to sing? And I'm telling you, I'll guarantee you. Well, I can't guarantee you, but I would bet that he's gotten a personal phone call from George Bush saying, just hang on, Scooter. We'll take care of you. Jim in San Francisco, California. Hey, Jim.
Hey. You know, I've heard, you know, reasons why Congress, especially the Democrats, might be reticent to pursue further hearings or even impeachment. I mean, that's what we're looking for, actually, because this thing's going to come down to impeachment if it goes. But, you know, look what happened to Clinton. He was enjoying, well over 60% approval rating at the time of his impeachment, while the public did not want impeachment. But the Republicans were not damaged at the polls. As a matter of fact, they made great headway in Congress. And
I know. I don't get it. Why Bob Schrum and why the Republicans, for that matter, why the Democrats have bought the Republican talking point that, impeaching Clinton was a huge mistake, that Republicans never should have done that, and, blah, 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 blah. And, therefore, you want to be sure that you don't ever impeach Bush, It's nonsense.
Look at the dynamic is completely the opposite. You've got.
Yeah, I agree. I agree.
Yeah, the public wanting impeachment, and the approval rating of Cheney especially has got to be in the teens.
Right. Although to be fair on the whole process here, Jim, impeachment is not a popularity contest, and that's why we need the investigations in the first place to demonstrate that actual crimes have been committed. And I'm telling you, the smoking gun is right here, and it's Scooter Libby. And as a caller earlier indicated, that apparently Andrew Sullivan, I believe it was, is saying, let's get Cheney under oath before Congress, and of course he will refuse to come. Chris in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Tom. You know, I agree with you. There is an under-the-table pardon in the works here, although that in and of itself is obstruction of justice, but you can't prove it. What I found interesting is the judge in this case, who was not very happy with Scooter Libby's defense team when it was clear that they weren't going to mount a defense, he only extended bail for Libby through the sentencing in June, pointedly not through the appeals process. And from what I can find out, that's kind of unusual in this kind of white-collar federal crime. My question.
You don't think it simply gets reset at the sentencing hearing?
I doubt seriously. Not as angry as that judge was. The point is that Libby might have to go to jail through the appeals process, which means the White House would have to throw a pardon earlier than they want to, because they do.
They sent him to a country club jail, a country club federal prison, where he works out and his abs and pecs are looking great when he gets out, and he's got a nice suntan, and he takes a year off and writes a novel while he's in jail.
Tom,
and
it doesn't work that way, though. Believe me, federal prisons, even minimum security federal prisons, you still have to get up at 6 in the morning and do what they want and fold laundry or make a license plate. So the point is they don't want Liddy in jail at all.
Yeah.
Because if he's facing months in jail, the White House will be forced to throw a pardon early. The one thing they don't want to do is throw a pardon before the 2008 presidential election. But they might be put in that position. And I think, this judge was angry enough to pointedly say you only have bail through sentencing, not through appeal.
That's very interesting, Chris. I didn't get that subtlety, and I appreciate your pointing it out. Thank you. Jerry in Long Island, New York. Hey, Jerry.
Yeah, thanks very much for taking my call. Yeah, on the Scooter Libby verdicts, I think I might have to disagree with you slightly. I mean, I don't think we have to choose just one reason why this whole Leakgate, as I call it, case happened. I mean, I don't think we political progressives should be fighting amongst ourselves, because I certainly agree with you on the reason you gave that this whole situation happened, in which we had this underlying crime of the classified information about Valerie Plame being a CIA operative being released. The reason you gave is I certainly accept that, but I also do think that the other reason that the information about Valerie Plame was released publicly was a form of retaliation by the Bush administration in general and by Dick Cheney in particular against Plame's husband, Joseph Wilson, of course, because he dared to speak truth to power and expose as a lie one of the Bush administration's main false BS reasons for going to war.
Yeah, okay. I'll give you that. I'm not saying that it's not that. I'm sorry, Jerry. I got a terrible echo here, but I'm not saying it's not that. But I'm saying that the big reason was not political payback and was not, you know, the big reason was to try to discredit Wilson, to discredit him so that the story would stop. That's what they were trying to do. Rick in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Rick.
Hey, how you doing, man?
Good.
Hey, I think those calls you're getting from people are coming from inside the house because you're not streaming on the Internet.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. You said questions. They are literally.
Okay, actually, we're getting calls from people listening on the radio stations. But if the web stream is down, it's every now and then something screws up. So, but it'll be back up. It's 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Larissa Alexandrovna coming up next with breaking news. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio. Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, your minimum daily adult requirements of sanity.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour, the second hour of our program. We've all heard the allegations that the CIA is running secret prisons, essentially in violation of international law around the world. And we've all heard that various countries have denied that they're the home to them. Larissa Alexandrovna is with us with Raw Story, rawstory.com. Hey, Larissa, welcome to the program. Larissa? Hello, Larissa! Okay, well, apparently Larissa's not listening to the phone. I'll just go ahead with this for a second, and hopefully when Larissa is listening, she'll notice. Or maybe she can't hear us. I don't know. Folks at New York, you can check the board. The CIA operated, this is what she's writing in today's Raw Story, along with David Datsich. The CIA operated an interrogation and short-term detention facility for suspected terrorists within a Polish intelligence training school. In other words, they have found the location. They have finally found the place. Where was it that these guys were doing this? Larissa has nailed this down. Intelligence officials identify, this is the story, the site as a component of a Polish intelligence training school outside the northern Polish village of, I think it says we'll ask her to pronounce it. Let's see if Larissa is back with us. Larissa, can you hear me?
I can.
Oh, great. Okay. Yeah, apparently you couldn't before. Larissa Alexandrovna, the investigative reporter for Raw Story, rawstory.com. Give us the essence of the story that you are breaking right now over at rawstory.com.
Well, basically, we've identified at least one of the so-called secret prisons across that were allegedly used across Eastern Europe for the detention and possibly torture of detainees as part of the rendition program used by the CIA. That's basically the story in a nutshell.
Yeah, and now these are places that essentially everybody has been denying exist, although the CIA has been saying that they do have a rendition program. Yes, it's legal, but no, we're not doing it. I mean, what's the status of what the CIA and the U.S. government has been saying about this up until this point?
Well, I mean, they initially denied any role in any torture or rendition program. After a while, as facts became started trickling out, as innocent people who were rendered and tortured came forward, it was something they could no longer deny, and they admitted to using the rendition program, but they never admitted to the secret system of prisons, and and they never admitted to torture, and I think that's key. Although now, you know, obviously everyone is saying both, you know, the interrogation program and the rendition program are, you know, are done, they're over.
Right, and we've had in two countries, as I recall, in Italy and in Germany, or was it Spain and Germany? You have actual countries issuing subpoenas for or actual indictments against CIA officers or people associated with CIA officers for kidnapping people off the streets of those countries and banishing them.
It was it is Italy and Germany, and I believe it was 13 in Germany CIA agents or officers. I'm not quite sure, and I think it was around 20 some, maybe 25 in Italy.
Right.
So yeah, I mean this is over there. It's a big scandal, although it's not being covered here at all, and it should be because you know.
Well, this is a huge story that you've actually found and identified the site of one of these secret CIA concentration camps. I don't know what else to call them.
Prisons. Yeah, I'm reluctant to call them prisons because they're not your typical prison. It's not like Guantanamo where you have a standing facility that whose purpose is a prison. What they're doing is they're using buildings that may have another purpose that are not built as prisons, but they'll use a part of the facility in the short term to interrogate people, and usually that's very limited in terms of time, and then they're off again, rendering them to a whole other facility. But I think the reason that people have been unable to find the secret system of prisons is because people have been looking for prisons, like, you know, standalone overt prisons.
And it's interesting, after the Cold War it kind of fell apart, in fact 1 or 2 years after the fall of the Soviet Union, one of my three children was majoring in foreign languages. She speaks German fluently, English, Russian, and Ukrainian, and wanted to improve her Russian, and she speaks a little Japanese too. And so she took a little less than a year, you know, three semesters, and went to Simferopol, which is the old spy training school in the southern Ukraine where Carlos the Jackal was trained. And they had converted this old spy training school into a language school and were soliciting foreign students because, you know, they had the faculty, they had the buildings, they had everything right there.
Right.
And apparently it's a similar facility. It's in Poland, where they would train spies in everything from language to spycraft, that is the place where the CIA has been stashing people.
Right. I mean, we don't know how many, but we know, or for how long, but we know that this facility in Kijkuti is the facility, at least one of the facilities in question, and that there are others we do not know, but we do know that Poland is absolutely not cooperating with the European Union in their investigation. And I think it needs to be pointed out that you know, the United States and Poland and Britain are all signatories to the Conventions Against Torture and to the Geneva Conventions. And the fact that, you know, this is breaking international law in several different countries, and that in each country only a few people were aware of anything going on, and that they lied to the rest of their own government.
Hmm.
So essentially, you have a handful of people in each country.
Yeah,
who are
only the, Only the Polish prime minister and the top intelligence brass, for example, in Poland knew about it.
Right,
this.
Exactly. Nobody else knew. And, you have to wonder. I mean, these are supposed to be democratic countries, yet their own governments don't know what's going on. And you have a handful of people in each country who are able to decide somehow what laws apply or do not apply.
This is a political bombshell, Larissa Alexandrovna of RawStory.com, that you and David, how do you pronounce his name?
Dostich.
Mm-hmm. The Polish reporter, that you and David are dropping right into the middle of the European Union and right into the middle of Poland. What sort of fallout are you expecting, and have you experienced any pressure from any governments not to release this story?
I don't know, frankly, what to expect. I know that Poland pretty much would not cooperate with any part of our investigation. There was some pushback in terms of writing the story and revealing certain pieces of information, but we decided to write it anyway. We did write it responsibly. We did we didn't include everything. But we felt that this was a story that needed to be told morally. It's a moral story. The moral question wins here. And, I do want to say that David Dostich isn't just a reporter. He was actually a Polish asset, an intelligence operative. And he had, for 14 years, served as a double agent for the CIA.
From 73 to 87.
Yeah, until he was caught by the Russians and imprisoned for espionage. So, he's since become a reporter. This is a big story, not only because, you have some journalist somewhere deciding, I don't care about national security, which isn't true, I do. But you have someone also who knows Polish intelligence, knows
And it is blowing it up. We only have about 20 seconds left. Larissa Alexandrovna, this story, Tony Blair, George W. Bush, and the Polish Prime Minister, Leszek Miller, have these guys committed international crimes? I mean, that seems to be the bottom line here.
Well, I'm not an attorney, but I would think that requires an investigation, and no one's cooperating. That's the problem. So who's going to investigate?
Yeah, well, there's the International Court at The Hague, and there's the United States Congress. There's two places to start.
That would be nice. Yes, it would.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see how it plays out. People can read about it over at rawstory.com. Larissa Alexandrovna, thanks so much for being with us, Larissa.
Thanks for having me.
And for the extraordinary investigative reporting work that you've done, not just on this story, but on so many others. I have tremendous respect for you and the work you're doing. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartmann Radio Program on Air America Radio.
Listening to the Tom Hartmann Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
Program where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. This is a huge story that Larissa Alexandrovna and David Dostich have broken over at rawstory.com. And I encourage you to get over and read it. And it'll be really interesting to see if the corporate media in America decides to pick this up and run with it or not. In the meantime, a congratulations. Yeah, sometimes, it's more important to catch people doing things right than catch people doing things wrong. I like to catch folks doing things right and say, hey, good on you. And it's actually one of the most effective ways to motivate folks, for those of you in management. But here, this is just MoveOn.org. They're calling on Congress to stop the escalation into Iran. And you can, this is their political action committee. You can get to it by going over to MoveOn.org, obviously. They're going to deliver more than 200,000 MoveOn petitions signed by members urging Congress to support a bill that would discourage military escalation into Iran. And this is in support of a bill introduced by Jim Webb, the senator from Virginia, who took down Mr. Mukaka. And good on you guys. I think it's just absolutely marvelous. That and then our conservative alert, back to back, our conservative alert for the day. Yes, it's just amazing. Over at Think Progress's blog, thinkprogress.org, they point out when Fox News's two favorite stories, the Fox Noise Machine, when their two favorite stories collide. This is the screenshot is great. O.J. Simpson claims he could be the father of Anna Nicole's baby. Their two favorite stories, back to back, O.J. Simpson and Anna Nicole Smith. Now, getting to a little more serious note, number one, it looks like not only do we have several cases now, Heather Wilson and Pete Domenici down in New Mexico hassling a federal prosecutor to get tough fast with a Democrat, investigate a Democrat before the election so that the Republicans can use it for political gain, and the federal prosecutor saying, wait a minute, I'm doing my job the way I'm doing my job. I'm doing it the right way. Thank you very much. I'm not doing this for your political purposes. And so Heather Wilson and Pete Domenici apparently reporting this guy to the administration as he's not a loyal enough partisan. See, this is all about single-party rule. This is about Politburo politics in the United States coming out. That's the Republican Party these days. And now in Washington State, the same thing. This is another federal prosecutor being bounced out, and apparently because Doc Hastings, you'll recall, is the Republican congressman from Washington State who was essentially so easily corrupted by Tom DeLay that when the House Ethics Committee was looking into Tom DeLay's ethics and had already reprimanded him three times, Tom DeLay said, okay, and they got rid of the guy who was on there and put in Doc Hastings. And he apparently, along with Harriet Myers, or through Harriet Myers, had tried to intervene in getting a federal prosecutor to mix himself up in the whole Washington State election thing, where Christine Gregoire, the governor, won by a small margin. And for months, Dino Rossi, as I recall, was his name, the guy who was running, the Republican who was running, was screaming vote fraud and the machines were rigged and this, that, and the other thing. I mean, the Republicans, when they think that there's vote fraud going on, they don't stop. They just went on and on and on about this thing. And the federal prosecutor said, you know, I got other things to worry about right now, or it's on the list, but it's not going to happen this week. And so that guy gets the axe, right? You've got, and here we have, what, six or seven federal prosecutors now who have been bounced out. But the most important thing, I think, today, one of them, I mean, here we have, you know, Poland and the EU melting down, Larissa's story, and the Scooter Libby trial demonstrating, in my opinion, that what this is all about is not political payback. This isn't petty partisan politics. This is the Bush administration trying to cover up a high crime, perhaps a treasonous high crime, lying to the American people in order to get us into a war, in order to get political capital. Cindy Sheehan laid this out as George Bush told his biographer back in 1999.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, "One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency," end quote.
You get it? A war for political capital? So that the whole right-wing machine can say,
Roosevelt is dead! His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
Yeah, we're going to privatize Social Security. We're going to do away with unemployment. We're going to get rid of federal health care programs. Yeah! Oh, man. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
And kick off your shop shine shoes. Leave the kids at your mama's and take off the Timbuktu. So give me 2 cents of mugger trash, leading off to where I bang it under.
Friends, welcome back to Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where reason is our lifestyle choice. Julian and Lauren in New York, David and me here in the People's Republic of Portland, Oregon, and having a fine time. Our telephone number, 866-303-2270. You can drop by our live chat room. Go to tomhartman.com, and right up at the top of the page, just click the live chat link, and it'll get you in there. It's free. It's easy. And, of course, blogging over at airamericaradio.com. Ellen in Boston, Massachusetts. Hey, Ellen, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi, Ellen. What's up?
Well, I got all kinds of things for you.
Well, pick one, because I got a whole bunch of callers
okay.
here, too.
Well, first of all, when were you in Bogota?
I would have to go back and look. I think it would have been the late 1980s, maybe the early 1990s.
Okay, because I was there fall of 1982. Did you ever meet a man named Papa Gringo?
No, no.
He was working with Children of the Americas. He was a white guy from the United States. We had a school program that it was all American students, but we were living with Colombian families. But I met a guy whose name was Angel Lozano. I think he eventually came to the United States, and I'm telling where he is now. He grew up on the streets.
Yeah.
Was worried about getting the other kids off the streets. Then we were talking. I was a double major in religion and Spanish.
Yeah.
I went to Bogota for my Spanish major. But Angel and I kept talking about God. And he'd had tried to get help from the churches. He'd had the door slammed in his face so many times that he told me, God's inside of everybody. There's no such thing as an overarching loving God.
Yeah, that's not a message that goes over well, you know, particularly with the Catholic Church down there. We actually, and thank you for the call, Alan, we were offered some property down in the Medellin Valley and went down there and looked at it and discovered that there had been a slaughter down there because it was kind of in the middle of the drug wars. So went back to talk with the Archbishop of Bogota. I'm not Catholic, so I'm not all that up on the various titles. And the person with me, Elizabeth Blinken, who was a German who was married to a Colombian man who was basically running our program in the La Paz slum, was with me. And we went in and met with him to, you know, say thanks for the offer of the property, but no thanks, we're not going to take it. And Elizabeth wasn't supposed to speak. That was, you know, what we were told before we went in. But she just was itching, and she finally said, you know, why don't you just, you know, she said birth control is not illegal here, but a lot of pharmacists are afraid to sell it because they're afraid that they'll go to hell forever. And why don't you just, you know, make a dispensation or something, you know, that pharmacists can sell birth control because we've got a terrible population problem with all these street children, you know, unwanted kids here being born in Colombia. And he wouldn't look at her. He looked at me, and he started pounding his fist on the arm of his throne and telling me, you know, Eve ate the apple. Women brought, you know, original sin into the world. They know when they're fertile. They know when and just going off on this rant as Elizabeth and I are, you know, backing out of his, you know, kind of throne room there. It was actually pretty spooky. But no, you don't want to take on religion or large institutionalized religions. Particularly in some of these countries, I'll tell you. Hutch in Tramfador, New Jersey? Hutch?
Yeah.
Hey.
Hey,
how do you pronounce your city?
Tom, I didn't hear you. So this is the mighty Hutch calling from his bunker in beautiful Tralfamador, New Jersey.
Tralfamador, okay.
Yes, sir. Sitting here in my hot tub with the 25,000-inch colored plasma TV. I just wish we could buy some groceries. So, Prince Tom of Hartman, the news just keeps coming. This is a blowout bombshell news. It's incredible. That you just gave us from the folks at Raw Story. And on top of that, folks, it just keeps building and building. The news keeps coming in. I don't mean to keep bothering you, Tom, but every day something's happening. Yesterday in Vermont, they have their required by law town meeting.
The town hall meetings, yeah.
March 6th. Out of 44 towns in Vermont, 36 voted to impeach or to bring troops home now. This is major.
Yeah, it absolutely is, Hutch, and I'm sorry, I got just a terrible echo, but it absolutely is, and well said, and thanks for bringing that up. I appreciate it. It's a good one. Jason in Montana. Hey, Jason, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, how are you doing?
Just great. What's up?
Well, I'm calling about the Libya issue. You know, I've been following it the past couple of days, and, you know, I know there's a big uproar, and I very vividly remember the Democrat Party, you know, prior to the election in November.
You mean the Democratic Party?
The Democrat Party, yeah.
There is no such thing as a Democrat Party, Jason. I'm sorry. There really isn't. There is no such thing. It's you know, Joe McCarthy used it as a slur, and it's used as a slur now, but there's no such thing as a Democrat Party. Sorry. And, you know, go back and read history. It was named by Thomas Jefferson the Democratic Republican Party. And in the 1790s and in the 1820s, they dropped the Republican part from it. And then the Republican Party in 1856, in June of 1856 in Jackson, Michigan, started as a separate party because it was then the Democratic Party. And it is the Democratic Party, and it is the longest political party in the history of civilization to have survived. And it is the Democratic Party. Neil in Kirkland, Washington. Hey, Neil, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Thanks so much for having Larissa on, because I got to say, Raw Story is right at the top of my list of sites to visit. Forget CNN, forget Fox. It's Raw Story. But there's another. You had a guest, Wayne Madsen, two, 3 months ago. And
yeah, Wayne's on the program a couple times a year. He's a good guy.
And he's recently reported on the meta story behind the story with the Cheney camp that actually Brewster Jennings was a pivotal player.
Oh, you're talking about the theory that Valerie Plame and Brewster Jennings intercepted a shipment of weapons of mass destruction from, I think it was Syria, going into Iraq, that were going to be there to be found by U.S. forces to justify the war. Is that right?
Well, that sounds interesting enough, but there is another connection between the Turkish and the Pakistani.
No, that's right. It was coming through Turkey. I'm sorry. You're right.
Yes, to Pakistan, and a huge proliferation of nuclear weapons to there was quite intentional, and no mistake.
Yeah.
It was a big money and big influence and power, so it still seems to be about the PNAC agenda. I mean, I'm not...
Yep, there you go. And all their buddies, including the Pakistani Secret Service, which wired $100,000 to Mohammed Atta in the week before 9/11. Gee, isn't that interesting? And we're still talking with these guys. John in Long Island, New York. Hey, John.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
I'm just great, but I'll get better. What's up?
I'd like to offer another aspect about the Scooter Libby verdict yesterday.
Yes, sir.
That the reason why the right-wing echo chamber is going ballistic asking for a pardon is reading Fire Dog Lake, one of Jane Hampshire's posts, young lady you had on the show yesterday. And she observed in the immediate aftermath of the verdict, she states, afterwards Mrs. Libby came up and hugged Jeffress, one of the defense lawyers, profusely, then Wells, saying love you with much emotion. Then all the rest of the defense team. And then Mrs. Libby didn't hug Scooter, however, or hold his hand or even make eye contact. I propose that that's one of the reasons why the echo chamber is going bananas, because if Scooter decided to flip, and I could think of no other reason why he would except from pressure of his wife, yeah, Scooter knows where the skeletons are buried.
Sure.
I'd like to hear your take on that.
Well, that's interesting. We got an awful echo here, John. I'll just let you listen on the air. If it was his wife who was contacted by Bush, who said, just tell Scooter to hang on, and I'll take care of him before the end of my term, maybe on the last day, but before the end of my term. And I'll make sure that you guys get, you know, $50 million somehow. I mean, consider the Bush family and businesses associated with it have received over $1 billion in the last 30 years just from the Saudi royal family and businesses associated with them. So it's not like these guys are short on you know, short change, chump change here. So, well, that's an interesting, you know, I didn't know that. That's a very interesting observation. Doug in Dearborn, Michigan, listening on WDTW. Hey, Doug.
Hello, Tom. I love the show. Absolutely love it. My comment is just I wonder how long it's going to be before Scooter Libby gets the same kind of cancer that Jack Ruby got and dies quietly somewhere.
Well, you know, Jack Ruby was trying to talk. Jack Ruby was being held on state charges in Texas, and starting about 3 months after he, as I recall, just a few months after he was first thrown into prison and figured out that he was going to be there for a good long time and that he wasn't, you know, going to be the hero that he thought he was and all that other stuff, he started sending letters to Earl Warren saying, if you'll get me out of this state, I will tell you the whole story. I'll give you all the details, but I've got to get out of Texas because if, you know, we can't even have a conversation here in Texas about this. And, you know, Earl Warren at that point had kind of washed his hands of the whole thing. And so Ruby was trying to talk. I don't think that Scooter Libby is going to try and talk. I think that he's been gotten to. I really do. So, you know, we'll see. I'm skeptical, Doug.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for the call. We'll see. We'll see. Lance in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Lance, got about a half a minute before a break here.
Yeah, Tom, I just wanted to know if you'd heard of the new mining program from Homeland Security called Advise.
The data mining program.
It is a mining program, and it replaces total information awareness.
Yeah. And it's,
so you've
it's
heard
been,
of it?
Yeah, I have. It's been reported in sort of the alternative media in a few places. Okay. I'm not sure that the mainstream media has covered it, but
this is in the Bellingham Herald today by Gannett News Service.
Yeah. Okay, I'll track it out. I'll
have a good day,
Lance. Thanks a lot. I appreciate the call. 45 minutes past the hour, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, right here on Air America Radio, the place where reason is our lifestyle choice.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
You to think. Actually, welcome back to the Real Free Speech Zone, the Tom Hartman Program here. Now, we need to look right straight at it and see what's going on. And it looks to me like this whole thing, this whole Scooter Libby thing, is all an attempt to cover up the fact that in 2001, before 9/11, in the summer of 2001, Silvio Berlusconi came over to the United States, met personally with George W. Bush, delivered to him documents that were forged by the Italian Secret Service. That this is following in the very early spring of 2001, the two break-ins at the Niger embassy and the home of the ambassador from Niger. And the woman who was busted for it worked for the Italian Secret Service. And these forged documents were given to Bush. Bush passed them along to CIA. The CIA said these are phonies. And as much as a year and a half later, Bush is then attributing these documents to the British, that this war was being sold to us in the spring and summer of 2001 before 9/11. It was sold to us after 9/11. It was sold to us based on false intelligence. They knew it was false. Joe Wilson had the temerity to stand up and say this is false, and And this is not, in my opinion, political retribution. This was an attempt by Cheney to stop the investigation from going any farther. And to a large extent, they succeeded, because now everybody's talking about, oh, this was political payback to Joe Wilson. And nobody is asking, well, why would they want to do political payback to Joe Wilson? I mean, he wasn't a politician. It wasn't about payback. It was about stopping the story, in my opinion. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us, talkradionews.com in Washington, D.C. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
You just heard my take on the Scooter Libby trial. I am of the opinion that there was a high crime or misdemeanor, an impeachable offense committed in the White House by George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, and that the smoking gun is this document that came from the Italian Secret Service and Bush's relationship with Berlusconi. And that's what they're trying to stop the press from investigating. That's from the very beginning. And that's what they're still trying to stop the press from investigating, with even the Washington Post doing this lukewarm editorial today, recycling right-wing talking points. Hey, this is no big deal, you know, blah, blah, blah. And that they still don't want that investigation to go on. What do you think?
I think you may be onto something, but I don't understand why it would be in the press's interests not to want this investigated.
Oh, I think the press has bought it hook, line, and sinker. I think that the I agree. Well, actually, no. Let me back up a little bit. There are some very powerful elements in the press. I mean, keep in mind, much of the mainstream press now is owned by defense contractors and large multinational corporations who are essentially in bed with the people who run everything from the Bush administration to large chunks of the Democratic Party. And I don't mean to sound like some conspiracy theorist, but the fact of the matter is that the corporate agenda very often is more important to these folks than any kind of ideology or political agenda. And, why was Phil Donahue taken off MSNBC when he was the single most popular and profitable program they had? Because he was saying, hey, wait a minute, we should think twice before we go into this war in Iraq. And why? Well, NBC is owned by General Electric, which is a major defense contractor. And if there's a war, ratings go up. So I think, you know, you can build a case. I don't think it's the case, but you can build a case that there are some elements within the media who would really rather not go there. But I think, frankly, it's just laziness. It looks like, you know, the juicy Anna Nicole Smith version of the story is Cheney's PO'd, and so he decides to kick Joe Wilson upside the head by attacking his wife. That's the tabloid version of it. But really what's going on is Cheney is terrified that Joe Wilson's revelation that there was no there with the Niger is going to lead to people discovering that this document that they were attributing to British intelligence had actually been in George Bush's hands in the summer of 2001, and it's now on the record.
You could well be onto something.
Yeah, I think this is about covering up an impeachable offense, and so anyway, end of my rant. What's going on in Washington, D.C. today?
Well, of course, I mean, that is the big story, at least the aspects of it that people are talking about, and they're not talking about the same aspect as you. The big parlor game in Washington, D.C. today is there going to be a pardon or isn't there going to be a pardon?
I think that's a done deal.
Generally, people do feel it was a done deal. Of course, these are the same people who yesterday thought there was going to be an acquittal. So
Right. Now, the proof that there's going to be a pardon was halfway through the trial. When they started the trial, Libby's defense was saying, you know, we're going to subpoena Karl Rove, we're going to subpoena Dick Cheney, we're going to prove that our client was just a small cog in a large machine, and he was just doing the bidding of others, and there's bigger fish to fry, and, you know, our guy Scooter was just following orders, basically. That's going to be our defense, and we will prove that to you. And then they never bothered to prove that, and they never bothered to call those people. All of a sudden, in the middle of the trial, the defense totally changed tactics, and I think it's because Scooter got a personal call from George W. Bush saying, you know, go along and we'll make sure that you a golden parachute is waiting for you. You may have to spend, you know, a few months in a federal prison. In all probability not, the way that appeals processes get dragged out. We're going to try and take down some federal prosecutors. We're going to try and get some judges in place. We're going to try and do everything we can to make sure that you're never going to show up for even a day in jail, and I'll pardon you the day that I leave.
I think many people feel that that's probably the way that it did go down.
And you know who the lawyer was who negotiated the presidential pardon for Mark Rich?
Who was that?
Scooter Libby.
Was it really?
Honest to God. He was the lawyer. He was a Washington, high-powered Washington lawyer during the Clinton administration, and he was the guy, Mark Rich was his client, he was the guy who negotiated the pardon by Bill Clinton of Mark Rich. So here you have Scooter Libby, a guy who is not at all unfamiliar with presidential pardons in the process
That's
involved.
That's very funny.
Yeah, well, I think it's more than funny. I think it's...
it's ironic, but it is.
Yeah.
You've got to admit it's funny.
Yeah, but what it says to me is that, you know, the presidential pardon process is something that probably more than most Washington insiders, Scooter Libby knows about and is not probably not afraid of and is willing to trust him. Because
well, whatever
you know,
happens to him, his career is not over.
No. The Republicans will always find a place for him. I mean, look at how at the CPAC conference, Tom DeLay shows up. He was treated like a rock star.
Oh, this guy is going to shine.
Yeah, incredible. Victoria Jones, TalkRadioNews.com. Thanks, Victoria. 57 minutes past
the Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
There's a lot on the table today. Larissa Alexandrovna over at Ross Story breaking the story that they have found in northern Poland the site of one of the CIA's secret imprisonment places where when we kidnap people off the street without any due process, without even notifying law enforcement, and banish them out of a country, we stash them. Apparently Tony Blair and George Bush and the Prime Minister of Poland colluding to keep this even from the Polish parliament. This is supposed to be a democracy. So we've got that story, number one. Number two, we've got the whole Scooter Libby thing going on, and the suggestion, it was the top op-ed piece on Common Dreams, probably still is by now, but you know, within an hour or so it'll be yesterday's top op-ed piece, suggesting, by David Lindorf, by the way, suggesting that the real story here, and I think he's absolutely right, is that the Bush-Cheney administration, this whole Scooter Libby thing, the reason that Dick Cheney went after Joe Wilson with such ferocity and immediacy is because he did not want it investigated why and where the story about Niger came from. That this was something that Silvio Berlusconi of Italy and George Bush hatched, or that the Italian Secret Service hatched and Berlusconi handed off to Bush, and Bush tried to use it, and the CIA said, no, we're not going to touch that. And then there was and this was all even before 9/11. And then another meeting happened, and they said, okay, let's recycle this thing. And this was then after 9/11, they had another meeting in Rome that Ahmed Chalabi was at, and a guy working for Doug Feith is at. And they say, okay, let's recycle this thing through British intelligence. And it ends up in the State of the Union address. The United States has learned through British intelligence that Saddam is trying to get uranium. Yeah. I believe that what we have here is a high crime and misdemeanor committed by the administration, and they're trying to bury that. And that's why there is an absolutely nonstop, unending chorus on the right from the Washington Post editorial today to the Wall Street Journal editorial and op-eds today to, I would virtually guarantee you, I haven't listened to them, but I virtually guarantee you, every right-wing talk show host in America, the whole echo chamber is going to be screaming, let Scooter go, so that he doesn't squeal on Dick Cheney and George W. Bush and reveal that treason has been committed here, in my opinion. So that said, we will get back to all that in just a few minutes. Plus, you know, and more abusive process. The head of the General Services Administration now, it looks like, the level of corruption in this White House has reached staggering levels. But first, you know, sometimes you know what you know, sometimes you know what you don't know, sometimes you're not even sure that you know what you didn't know, and sometimes even everything you know is wrong.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Could be. Everything You Know Is Wrong is sponsored by TheLiberalStore.com. All things liberal and bumper stickers, buttons, t-shirts, and more. Go check out the liberal teddy bear there. That's the, T-H-E, LiberalStore.com. Don't forget the in the URL. Tim O'Brien is with us. He's the author of a new book, The Power of Personal Branding, Creating Celebrity Status with Your Target Audience, thepersonalbrandinggroup.com. Another the there in a URL, thepersonalbrandinggroup.com. Hey, Tim.
I heard that, Tom. You know, I was thinking when you said the liberal store, I thought to myself, the personal branding group.
There you go. There you go. And in all probability, our listeners will as well. You know, Barack Obama is hot, a veritable political rock star. What makes his personal brand so appealing? And how can people in business or in politics, perhaps not at the level of Barack Obama, somebody running for county commissioner or somebody who wants to make their small business work more successfully, use these same techniques?
Well, I think it's a good question. There are two parts. First of all, what makes Barack hot is I think he's fresh. I also think that, you know, we are a people, not just America, but I mean across the world, who are very visual. He's handsome. You know, he is, he's smart. He's articulate. And so combine that with his freshness and he's a very compelling guy. I think people get tired and bogged down with the back and forth between the liberals and the conservatives, and I think he's a fresh voice. His real challenge will be, can he remain fresh? That's going to be his biggest challenge. And I also think what will be important for him...
And in a year and a half, it's going to be virtually impossible. So he's going to have to move from fresh to substance.
You know, Tom, you hit the nail on the head. I think that I often say these guys like Barack Obama or Rudy Giuliani, they're like rock stars. You know, they can say and do what they want because there's no real accountability. They're just incredibly popular figures. They're iconic. But all of a sudden, you're running for office, and now there's an accountability quotient, which is people are going to start measuring whether or not they want to vote for you, and it's a whole different ball game. And that's
right.
A real, that's tough for people.
So in your book, The Power of Personal Branding, you make specific, we're talking Tim O'Brien, the personalbrandinggroup.com, the website. You suggest that there are actual techniques that you can use to basically brand yourself.
Absolutely. And it's actually,
for example,
simple. Okay, here's what I want people to take away from this call. I want them to start, if they're a business person, the first thing they have to understand, or if they're an athlete, or if they're a politician, everybody has a brand. You know, Tom, you have a brand. You know, Lauren, who I talked to arrange the call, has a brand. I have a brand. Everybody has a brand. We don't get to choose whether or not we want to have a brand. What we do get to choose is it positive, negative, or neutral? So I want people to think, what's the word or phrase I want people to think of when they think of me? So you take a guy like Tom Hanks. What makes him wildly popular? He's a nice guy. He's just a nice guy. You take Brett Favre, who's a great football player. He's played 256 consecutive football games. His brand is he's tough. I think a lot of people think their brand is what they do for a living, and that's nothing could be further from the truth. We like Barack Obama because of a part of his humanness. There's a freshness to him. We don't like other people because of a part of their character. We don't hate them because they're real estate brokers. We love them because of who they are as people, or we dislike them because of a part of their character.
So
that's
when you now I'm assuming the congruence is absolutely vital here. That is to say that the part of yourself that you want to promote as your brand actually has to be a real part of yourself.
All right, so you're so right on the money. I mean, look at Rock Hudson. You know, I don't know, you know, what the age of the audience listening is, but Rock Hudson was a great actor, and you know, he portrayed himself and his people handled him and portrayed him as a lady killer. He actually was gay, and he really died very, very sadly at the very end because he was not authentic. And I think you have to...
Back in the 1950s, a gay man couldn't be authentic.
Very sad.
I mean, that's the tragedy of it. He was starring opposite Marilyn Monroe. He had a sham marriage that was set up by the studios because it was actually against the law to be gay in a lot of states.
You're right. And I think that... So what happens is the first thing you have to do is you have to decide, can I live with this brand every single day? Because it's really a part of who you are 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. Everything you do, Tom, adds to or takes away from your brand. Everything. Like the people who listen on your show, right? Many of them are very well politically informed. how you talk about the issues reflects on your brand. Are you hysterical? Are you a lunatic? Or are you thoughtful? Are you measured? Are you logical? And I think that people have to understand that everything they do either adds to or takes away from their brand.
Right. So now you've got your brand. You've figured out the word or words or phrase that you're going to use to describe yourself or your business. How do you get it out there?
You got to live it.
Or do you even want to? I mean, there's a certain part of me. I've you know, very often I'll turn down opportunities to go on TV, for example. I just am not all that interested in being, you know, quote famous or quote a star. I love doing radio. I'm a radio guy. I want to talk on the radio. I've loved it all my life, and I'm having a good time doing it. But you know, I have no aspirations beyond that, frankly. And I think that, you know, people at a certain level, you say, maybe I don't want to promote a particular brand. I just want to be what I am.
Well, I think that there's a difference there, and you're right. What you're really not is you're not intoxicated with celebrity and fame. There's a lot of people that want, like Paris Hilton's famous because she's famous.
Yeah, so this is really a uniquely American thing, that you can be famous for being famous.
You know, remember Zsa Zsa Gabor? She was the same way. You know, Telly Savalas, those guys were great movie stars. They weren't great actors. They were just great personalities, and they were famous because they were famous. So I think it's different. Every one of us, like, if your success depends upon a cooperation of another person, you got to work on your brand. Like, for example, if you wanted to say, you know, I don't care about people, I don't care about my brand, problem is people wouldn't listen to your show. So you have to decide, to what extent do I have to promote my brand? And you say to yourself, okay, Tim, the boundary for me is I'm not interested in going on TV shows because I'm not really interested in fame. I like my show. It gives me a chance to express my point of view, and I want to make sure that I'm promoting my brand to my listeners.
So just be consistent in it.
Exactly.
Tim O'Brien, the personalbrandinggroup.com, the website, the new book, The Power of Personal Branding, Creating Celebrity Status with Your Target Audience. Tim, thanks for being with us today.
Tom, you're dynamite for having me on. Thank you.
Thanks. Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say no.
Tuned in to the Tom Hartman program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
I hear the drums of war, they are changing, and everybody's getting in the groove, laughing and dancing and talking and jamming and singing. We got nothing but love. Everything's A-OK in the USA.
Well, we have a little work to do, but by and large, we're still here. Welcome back. Talk radio for the rest of us here in the USA, and still holding this nation together and still working hard to restore democracy to the United States of America, and also to do well by our vets. Larry Scott is with us. He's the editor and publisher of VAWatchdog.org, chief cook and bottle washer over there. Hey, Larry.
Hi again, Tom. Good to be with you.
Great to have you with us. The American Legion commander says, I blame the president and Congress. I've been waiting for somebody to say that Bush is so eager to grab the mantle of commander-in-chief and fly on aircraft carriers when he can be, you know, strutting around playing war president. But when it comes to his role as commander-in-chief in charge of the Pentagon's, the way the Pentagon deals with and takes care of our, not veterans, but our active duty servicemen, suddenly he's AWOL.
This is a message loud and clear from the national commander of the American Legion. By anybody's estimate, the most politically conservative of all the veterans organizations and the largest one, Paul Morin, national commander. He was speaking on NPR when they asked about the problems at Walter Reed and about the underfunding at the VA and veterans waiting for health care. He finally came out and said it. I blame the president and Congress. This is a message to the White House, and this is a message to Congress from a veteran service organization that has over 3 million members to stop this. Stop the baloney. Stop the lies. Let's get the funding going. I never thought I'd see this, but I'm very glad that Commander Morin came out and said it, because it is a loud and clear message from a very conservative organization. Let's get this problem fixed.
Yeah. Also over at VAWatchdog.org, Larry, I note that you have a headline, VA in panic mode adds 100 patient advocates.
Well,
Jim Nicholson, feeling the heat, huh?
Oh, well, let me tell you, they're feeling the heat over at the VA because of the troops, the problems with Walter Reed and the other military hospitals. There's a program called Seamless Transition where these troops are supposed to seamlessly transfer from military health care into the VA health care system. That has not happened. It is a shambles. It hasn't been funded properly. They don't have the people to staff it. Yesterday, Secretary Nicholson, the head of the VA, announced that he is hiring 100 new patient advocates. These are people who work inside the system to help veterans with their benefits and with problems they might have. These 100 advocates are going to be veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan, and their sole job will be to help the GIs transition into the VA system. This is a good move, but it's way too little and it's way too late. But you can tell that the VA's in panic mode. And we have another great story that just came across. I haven't had a chance to post yet. And that is the president is trying to make a big thing of this. There's too much red tape. We've got to cut the red tape. We've got to help these troops transition easily from the military into the VA healthcare system. So the president has announced a task force. It's called the Task Force on Returning Global War and Terror Heroes. I don't know how they come up with these names. The concept of the task force is to cut through all of this red tape. Make sure that our GIs are getting their benefits. Make sure they're getting them immediately. Guess who we named to head the task force? You got it. Jim Nicholson, Secretary of the VA.
You're kidding.
The fox is already in the hen house doing great damage to the VA and the health care.
And now he's supposed to evaluate himself.
Yeah, now I want you to write a good report about yourself, Jim. Well, as the picture at the top of VAWatchdog.org says, it's the president and Jim Nicholson. You're doing a heck of a job, Jimmy. And I have that little 24-second video clip where Nicholson, when confronted with the over 200,000 troops that have come into the VA, he said, well, and a lot of them come in for dental problems. But it's a wonderful little video, and you can just see on this man's face.
Mental disorders, 73,000. Diseases of nervous system, 61,000. Symptoms, signs, and ill-defined conditions, 67,000. Diseases of musculoskeletal system, 87,000. These are huge numbers beyond the 23,000.
A lot of them come in for dental problems.
Yeah. If it wasn't so tragic, it would be funny. But
that's really
tragic.
That's almost as good as a clip of General Kiley saying, "I don't inspect barracks at Walter Reed." Another little video clip I'll have up. We know you don't inspect barracks, General. We're reading about it.
Yeah, and all the more the tragedy.
It really is.
So you know, in a way, there's one of the interesting carry-home stories of this, Larry Scott, VAWatchdog.org, is that when enough people get mobilized, things happen. Enough people get angry, things could happen. And that's why I think, you know, a good national health care system, what this is telling us is that our politicians will be responsive. Whereas, you know, you try and take on your private health insurance company, you know, and they'll just laugh in your face and there's no recourse.
Well, we do hope that the Congress is responsive here. And we're looking at the new commission, of course, Bob Dole, Donna Shalala heading that up. We have high hopes for the recommendations of that commission.
Yeah, great. Okay, VAWatchdog.org, the website. Larry Scott, the proprietor. Larry, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Always great talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with your calls right after this. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, the True People's Radio.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
Minimum wage won't pay for a roof, won't pay for a drink. If you gotta have proof, distract yourself, Mr. CEO. See how far 5:15 an hour will go. Take a part-time job at one of your stores. I bet you can't make it here anymore.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense from the radical middle. 1-866-303-2270, your telephone number. Scott in San Diego, listening on KLSD. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Good morning, Tom. I think I'm going to have to protect my brand here. Sounds like there's somebody else calling in from Scott in San Diego, and I'm the only one. I'm the real deal.
Okay, you're the real Scott.
I'm the real Scott. Hey, listen, I caught you this morning when you were talking about the story within the story within the story, and I've been reading a lot of your NLP stuff, especially the Healing ADD, which actually should be called Harnessing the Hunter's Way. I think it'd be a better title.
It's a great title, yeah.
It works better because it's Healing ADD. It assumes that there's something wrong with it. When I read that, I'm, of course, pretty self-defensive here. There's nothing wrong with what I've got. It's really kept me ahead of the pack for a long time. Yeah. Anyway,
but your point, Scott, since we digress.
At one point in the Healing ADD book, you talk about what's really going on and important in telling story. It's not the surface story or even the story under that. The core story, you deal a little bit about this in your Walking Your Blues Way as well. The core story, what's really going on underneath, and you got to that. What I'd like to do is to relate the Libby trial to the story within the story, how that works, kind of relate the NLP stuff with that, how that works in politics, because it'd really help link stuff up for
Go ahead and please do it quickly if you can.
I can't.
You're asking me to. Oh, well, let me just give you the frame. It's very, very simple. The George W. Bush, before he came into office, told his biographer back in 1999 that if he became president, he would attack Iraq. That would make him fabulously popular as a wartime president. He would use that power then to roll back the New Deal, to accomplish the things that he had unsuccessfully run for Congress on back in 1977, privatizing Social Security, doing away with Medicare, doing away with the Department of Education, basically stripping the federal government down to nothing but an army. And that was his strategy. And the day after he came into office, according to his Secretary of the Treasury, and others around him. Yeah, the day after he came into the presidency, he got his cabinet together and he said, "Okay, how do we attack Iraq?"
Now,
I mean, this was long before
9/11.
Right, and then he set about to sell the American people on the attack of Iraq,
starting with the layer on top of the core story.
Yeah, now the layer on top of the core story is that he discovered that Americans really didn't want to attack Iraq, and nothing he said could make them want to attack Iraq. So 9/11 came along, and he said, okay, how can we conflate Iraq with this? And that, since Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11, required a series of lies. And that's where he went wrong, is when he started telling the lies.
What Wilson did was
exposed the lies.
One of the lies. But you were saying this morning that when he exposed those lies, the real thing was the treasonous... That Bush had gotten together with Berlusconi on a secret mission to hatch this. Now, that's the story.
Well, Bush was already explicitly trying to do this. Berlusconi was sucking up to Bush. Berlusconi was, you know, trying to be good friends with, you know, the most powerful force in the world, and also a guy who I think he modeled himself after politically. Berlusconi really, either Bush or Mussolini, one or the other. And so Berlusconi says to his intelligence service, hey, cook something up that I can use, that I can take as a gift to my friend George. You know, usually people show up at the White House with a gift, and, you know, it's like a piece of china from, you know, crockery from China.
Dolls where one was inside the other, inside the other.
Yeah, right. The Russian, the babushka dolls or something like that. He says, you know, give me a gift here. And they said, okay, fine. We'll break into the Nigerian embassy and we'll steal some letterhead and some stamps and we'll give you this phony information that Saddam Hussein is shopping around in Niger for uranium. And that was the gift that Berlusconi brought Bush. And Bush ultimately used it. Scott, thank you very, very much for the call and for raising it. It's a good point. It's a very good point. Cynthia in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Cynthia, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. You know, I also like Larissa Alexandrova, and she has a good blog called At Largely. And she reports a lot on what's going on with Russia. I happen to think that the Team B members are back, and they're killing people to blame on Putin. She doesn't share that view.
Well, the Team B members, you're talking about Wolfowitz and Cheney and Rumsfeld. I mean, that was, you know, Wolfowitz was the head of Team B, and we're talking about back in the 1970s in the Jerry Ford administration when Dick Cheney was the chief of staff and Don Rumsfeld was the secretary of defense, and Rumsfeld came up with this wacky idea that the Russians had a super secret submarine that was so secret that we couldn't even detect it. And when the CIA said there's no such thing, he said, "See, I told you so." And and put Wolfowitz in charge of Team B. And this was all in response to Nixon in 72, having come back from Russia with a treaty, as I recall, it wasn't the ABM treaty, it was another one, basically the treaty that said, okay, we're going to destroy all our nuclear weapons over time. And Nixon came back and he gave his famous speech where he said, the era of fear is over. And these guys live on fear. They have to have fear. And, you know, Rumsfeld's job before he became Secretary of Defense in the Bush administration was as a lobbyist for the defense industry.
Yeah, she even reports that one of these Chechen leaders is blaming one of these oil oligarchs for killing that journalist.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me. I mean,
But her thing about Poland, a couple weeks ago it was reported that an Iranian general has been taken into custody. Now it's being reported that he defected, but he's being held somewhere in northern Europe. So I wonder if he's in Poland.
Yeah, well, he may well be. He may well be.
But there are a couple... Yeah, let me get to why I originally called. Until we get to the bottom of this, the root of the evil that is plaguing us now is these oil smugglers and these arms smugglers. Nothing is going to change. You mentioned Mark Rich. You should check out an article from Business Week called The Rich Boys. And when he was smuggling oil out of Iraq, when that started to become public, you didn't hear any more from Fox News about, you know, the oil smuggling network. And now you've got Bush and Cheney trying to cover up the AQCON smuggling network, in my opinion.
Sure. I absolutely agree with you, Cynthia. I think you're right. I think you're spot on. And let's not think of it as just, you know, some bizarre kind of quiet, secretive criminal enterprise. These smuggling networks are very often involved, intermeshed with giant multinational corporations and political bodies as well. Carolyn, is it Falmouth, Maine?
Yes, Falmouth, Maine. Hi, hey, Tom.
Carolyn, what's up?
I want to thank you for your sharp detective work. You're giving me hope for the future.
Well, thank you. Actually, I don't claim credit for this. The story that really pointed this whole thing out to me was Dave Lindorf's piece in commondreams.org, and I recommend you read it.
I'm going to definitely read that, too.
Yeah, it's excellent.
I hope that you and your listeners will participate in our national grand opening of an ongoing free benefit auction for critical issues. Mm-hmm. And you sell all types of items and then donate 1 to 100% of the sale directly to your selected charity or media resource.
Okay. You want to plug a website?
Yes. It's called Classified Circles with an S at the end of circles.org.
Great. Okay, Carolyn, you got it out there, and good luck, and I wish you well on it. Matthew in classifiedcircles.org. Matthew in Sonoma County, California. Hey, Matthew, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, good to talk to you. And, hey, thanks for the segue leading into the Mark Rich story. You know, the idea that Scooter Libby was the attorney for Scooter Libby before he worked for Dick Cheney back in the late 80s, early 90s, and Fitzgerald was the prosecutor who was prosecuting Rich and was highly annoyed with the pardon of him. And then you also discussing how this whole idea of invading Iraq and everything was hatched in 1999. All this leads to who was running the country back then. It was not George Bush and his quote-unquote cronies running the country then. It was your Democratic Party running the country. And I just continually...
Actually, I would submit to you that the House and the House of Representatives and the Congress was basically... Pardon?
Not the Senate in 99. The House of Representatives was, but not
the House of and frankly, the power structure in this country transcends political, the political boundaries.
Exactly, my point.
I would say that the issue here is conservative versus liberal, not Democrat versus Republican.
I wouldn't even say that. I would say it's the haves versus the have-nots, and the haves will continually buy people into power who will continually give back to them. Just like the redistricting here going in California, how nobody is voting for it because, as the ex-mayor of San Francisco, Willie Brown, stated, why would politicians give up their own power?
Yeah, tragically. And that's one of the reasons why we have to have good point, Matthew, why we have to have publicly funded elections, why we really need to be working for that, and why, you know, the Green Party's work of trying to get instant runoff voting, for example, so we can have multiple parties on ballots is so important at the local level, doing this all across the country. Dale in San Francisco. Hey, Dale, we have just about a minute before we've got to take a break.
Thanks for having me on, Tom, first time caller. Something I think and have always thought since the very beginning of this Valerie Plame affair is the method used by the administration to attack Joe Wilson is the subliminal message sent to the CIA.
Mm-hmm. You think that this was as much a message to the CIA? Well, that makes perfect sense. Yeah, that and by the way, and since it was the CIA that had originally rejected the Niger document when Berlusconi first brought it over and gave it to Bush, and then the thing got recycled through British intelligence, and even then the CIA was saying, hey, wait a minute, this is a phony document, you shouldn't put it in the State of the Union speech, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, that you could good point, Dale. You can see where it would be very much in the interest of Bush and Cheney and company to say to the CIA, don't you dare talk about this. And obviously, if they could discredit Joe Wilson, to shut the story down. Because that's the story that they don't want discussed, is how did those 13 words get in the State of the Union address? Because it was part of a larger conspiracy to lie us into a war, which is an impeachable offense.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
Moving toward a bright and sparkling future by returning democracy to the United States of America. Tom Hartman here with you. Kate in Arcata, California. Hey, Kate, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. This isn't why I called, but I had to just make a remark about the veterans. I heard Cheney right after this broke about Walter Reed. I heard him make a statement that was obviously, thanks to listening to you, I recognized it, creating a frame. And he said that we're going to take action, and we're not going to let the federal bureaucracy get in our way to speed
right,
up the
which is a way of starting to promote privatization.
Exactly.
And in fact, it's privatization. It's a contractor that was put together by an old Halliburton guy that has been largely responsible, apparently, for much of this mess at Walter Reed.
Well, that's really interesting. It's yet another thing that they're willing to break in order to privatize it. You've been saying that for a long time.
Yep.
The reason I called, though, is that what was also going on in the summer of 2001, which was apparently a very active summer for everyone except for George Bush, who was on vacation, but what was also going on was that Bin Laden, there's an article in The Guardian, Thursday, November 1st, 2001, by Anthony Sampson, who's since died. But 2 months before September 11th, Bin Laden was in Dubai for 10 days for treatment at the American hospital, and he was visited by a CIA agent.
Right.
And this was reported in the French newspaper Le Figaro. And the disclosures came from French intelligence. And apparently, an American CIA agent visited him, and that CIA agent was later recalled to Washington. So it seems to me that this is really an important story that nobody talks about. And because along with this, in January of 2001, the Clinton administration had informed the Bush administration that, yes, it was Bin Laden who had blown up the coal.
Right.
So,
well, actually, it was the week after Bush was sworn in that both the CIA and the FBI agreed on that. So
it wasn't clear.
The administration. It was. But yes.
But he was an enemy of the United States, and he was let go, and then, 2 months later, he's the perpetrator against us. It seems to me, or against, you know, whatever. Anyway, it seems to me that even the most conservative person, if they knew this information, if this was well-known.
Yeah, they would say there's something fishy here. You're absolutely right, Kate, and, you know, well said. I absolutely agree with you. Bill in Queens, New York, not the Queens. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Hey, Tom, thank you very much for taking my call. Thank you for your show. The one thing I wanted to, for you to clarify, if you could, is the reason that Berlusconi gave the gift of the documents, the forged documents, to Bush?
Well, nobody knows. I'm just speculating. My guess is that he wanted to ingratiate himself with Bush. He wanted to have political brownie points with the leader of the free world.
Right, right.
You know,
okay.
And at the time, I mean, there really was this alignment happening between the very the pro-Bush and conservative leaders in Europe, which was basically at that time it was becoming Berlusconi and Blair and Merkel might be coming. Merkel wasn't in power at that time, I don't think. But there were several, and then the anti-Bush, frankly, the very worried about Bush leaders in Europe,
right.
And Berlusconi was trying to stake out his territory as an I'm on your side guy, in my opinion. You know, it's not inconceivable that that Bush had somehow communicated to Berlusconi.
Right.
Could you have your Secret Service do this for me? And Berlusconi was just doing a job he was asked to do. I don't know. And these are the kind of things that we need to have congressional investigations to find out. And you raise a very good point, Bill, and I appreciate you calling. Tom in Sleepy Hollow, New York. Hey, Tom, you wanted to set me straight on the Donahue Show?
Yeah, just a small correction. I know that accuracy is important to you. While it was the number one rated show on MSNBC when it was canceled, there's evidence from Keith Olbermann himself that it was not really profitable. He mentioned that on a Fire Dog Lake check back in November. I put a link on the discussion boards under the on-air questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and yet at the same time, you know, what went public was the memo within GE and NBC that, you know, we can't have this guy talk, and this is the time to be waving the flag.
Well, it was a reason, but there's more complexities. It had twice the staff of any other show they had.
Yeah, but see, if that's the case, then what you do is you go to the show and say, hey, if you want to continue doing your TV show, you're going to have to cut your staff back.
And Keith did mention that he was kind of inflexible. Now, so you can see his words yourself. You can go to the link.
Okay, I'll check it out, Tom.
All right.
Thanks a lot, and thanks for the call, and thanks for putting it up on the blog. You know, it's really, you're right. It's good to be accurate. Joseph in Delmont, Pennsylvania, listening on WPTT. Hey, Joseph, what's up?
Tom, the picture you've been painting this afternoon, it makes it quite obvious that 9/11 was not only orchestrated, but allowed to happen by this administration.
Well, I'm not yet to the point where I can say it was orchestrated by them, but I will absolutely agree with you that it was allowed to happen. 56 specific warnings were delivered to George Bush that we know of from the 9/11 Commission report. I mean, you know, 56 times somebody comes and says to you, hey, they're going to burn a cross in your yard, or they're going to burn down your barn, or somebody's going to shoot out your tires, and then it happens, and you go, gee, how did that happen? Come on, give me a break.
I agree, but I want to know who aided in imploding those buildings. Because the technology that was put into place to bring them done, it's been proven it was not just brought all three buildings done. They were imploded.
Yeah. No, I don't know, Joseph. And frankly, because they scavenged all the raw materials together and shipped most of it off to China for recycling, we will never find out because the evidence was destroyed. Kirk in Westbrook, Maine, listening on 870 The Voice. Hey, Kirk, just a few seconds before we have to wrap the show.
Yeah, I just want to say that I love the fact that you're bringing up the whole topic of what came sort of before this whole Valerie Plame incident and where did those forged documents actually come from. When the story first broke, I remember doing some internet research, and there was information leading me to believe that there were people involved in Italy at the time.
Yeah, it was. It went right back to Italian intelligence. It absolutely did. Coming up tomorrow on the program, Teresa Tomeo and I are going to be arguing about Jesus' coffin. Heather Vokush is here on the decline of U.S. mental health under Bush, and Greg Powell.